The FCA-UAW contract, Tesla goes sort of hands-free, and VW recalls a few cars.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vaslash, episode 306 for October 16th, 2015. Sergio, Elon, and the Brady Bunch.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Good afternoon, everyone. You know, if you listen to the tease, it's always three things. And I was thinking on the way over that I would say, no John, no guests, no cars in the studio. But all that said, this is going to be a great show because we have a panel of very knowledgeable people about the auto industry. So Sharon Carty, editor-in-chief of Yahoo Autos. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing really well myself.
Good.
And sitting next to Sharon is our good friend Scott Burgess, who is the Detroit editor of Motor Trend and who will soon be working for
Sharon.
So you're going to Yahoo Autos?
Yeah, I start next week. I stay at Motor Trend. And
Friday would be tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
For those who are watching this in real time.
And I'm really excited about it.
So what will you be doing?
One of the things we've talked about is writing a car consumer column to kind of break down issues for consumers, whereas at Motor Trend, I did a lot of enthusiast-oriented things. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a whole gamut of issues that you can talk about that the consumers want to learn. I mean, who cares about a self-driving car if you could have a self-cleaning car? What are all of the other issues that consumers are really concerned about? I think that it's there's an endless number of topics that you can cover in that, mm-hmm. and I'm really excited about going there.
So Sharon, just to before we go to, so for those who haven't looked at Yahoo Autos, what is Yahoo Autos?
So Yahoo Autos, we've got like a nice combination of the enthusiast stuff. We've got Alex Lloyd on staff, his former race car driver, who gets to do like some. He has a really good touch of bringing, you know, what it's like to be a race car driver, but bringing it to the average mm-hmm. people. But then we also have a big consumer side of things. And one of the reasons why I'm really excited that Scott's coming on board is because Scott's got that, like, you know, really good BS detector mm-hmm. and a really good eye for, like, you know, what's interesting and what's unique. And, mm-hmm. You know, we're just trying to hit a lot of topics that are maybe not sort of insidery car biz stuff, but are the things that people talk about, mm-hmm. like to talk about. I think a lot of people are surprised when I say that, you know, one of the biggest topics I get approached about when I go to baby showers is cars. And people don't really expect that, but like wedding showers, baby showers, uh-huh. I end up talking a lot of cars. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there's a lot of interest out there. It's just not the same sort of conversations that you have when mm-hmm. you're sitting around with a lot of auto journalists. So.
And which is exactly what we're doing today.
Yeah.
So the third member, so it's all threes, you know, no cars, no John, no guests. But mm-hmm. we've got Mike Whalen, who is the Fiat Chrysler beat reporter.
Yeah.
So, you know, we got to start with you. So Fiat Chrysler and the UAW.
That is happening, isn't it?
That is happening. That, and I'm surprised you look so well rested. So they've got a tentative contract, which they're voting on next week.
Tuesday and Wednesday, and it's their second tentative contract now after 65% of the membership voted it down the first time around.
So tell us about this new contract, okay? So one thing that isn't quite clear to everyone, that there were two wage tiers in the company. One is like regular pay, and then one was
traditional pay for veteran workers. It was $28 more an hour, mm-hmm. and those are the guys who have been there since pre-2007. And then there was a second tier that was kind of slipped in there in 2007, And it started under $17 mm-hmm. and kind of topped out right around $22 under the first deal. Mm-hmm. But in this new contract, the workers will actually have a path under 8 years, though, to get to traditional wages, they're calling it, of about $29 an hour or more. Mm-hmm. But the biggest problem is, and the biggest concern for this deal, is that it's a four-year deal.
And so the contract runs for 4 years, but it says in 8 years, you'll be able to get the prize at the end.
Yep, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow with mm-hmm. traditional wages. They won't mm-hmm. get the same benefits as the first tier right now. But there's a lot of mistrust out there because in 2011, in the UAW highlighter, they said there was going to be a 25% cap on the entry-level hires, and Fiat Chrysler is at 45% now.
And so that's the greatest. So that's the greatest number of Tier 2 workers at any automaker?
Yeah. GM's at about 20, and Ford's at about 28%. And Ford has actually bumped some of theirs up to first tier. Fiat Chrysler just keeps wanting to collect those second-tier workers and get them in there. I mean, it saves them thousands of dollars in health care coverage, not to mention the wages alone.
Mm-hmm. So the reason the first one didn't work out was because of this?
It was a lot of not bridging the gap enough and not having a path to get to that traditional wages. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the expectations going into the talks were impossible almost to meet. There was a lot of pent-up aggression from the past 14 years. Or 10 years of the veteran workers not getting any raises. The two tiers, a lot of them were voting for the first time. And the UAW at their convention, it's our time. Mm-hmm. That was their slogan. That was right. their mantra. And bridge the gap was their other. Well, a lot of workers took bridge the gap and turned it into eliminate the gap mm-hmm. and remembered it's our time, but not right. that they're trying in a negotiation and they're not going to get everything.
Mm-hmm. So do the tier one workers get a raise?
They get 3% lump sum raises the first and third year of the contract, and then the second and fourth, they get a 4% lump sum payment. So there's enough built in there where a lot of people think that this one will get ratified, but, I mean, it's still probably going to be pretty close.
And then plus there's a signing bonus, a ratification bonus.
Yeah, the ratification bonus, it actually got bumped up to $4,000 for the veteran workers under the new deal. It was $3,000. And then the entry level will still get $3,000. But, I mean, that signing bonus is pretty much just a please do this and don't worry about the details kind of thing.
Does this split the UAW? Do the lower tier workers work against the upper tier workers or vice versa?
I mean, they work on the same line, and a lot of workers have said it's just divided the factory floors. Some of the veteran workers said, if we can get rid of the two-tier pay system, I don't need a raise, I don't need this. But then the contract negotiations actually came around and got voted down 65% when it didn't eliminate that gap. So we'll have to see what happens this time around. But, yeah, there's been a huge contention of people just saying it divides the factory floors. It's not equal pay for equal work, which the UAW's mounted itself on for decades.
So, are there any examples? That's always been my curiosity. Like, how is it dividing the floor? Are people, getting into arguments? Is it the lower-tier workers are feeling aggression against the higher-tier workers? Or, what are they fighting about?
It's going against everything the UAW stood for, the equal pay for equal work. And the veteran workers feel bad that the younger guys aren't getting their full pay when they're literally doing the exact same job on the assembly line. And then the kind of entry-level workers who have been working and a lot of them were promised that they were going to get moved up under the 2011 agreement aren't going to just get magically bumped up to that $28 an hour anymore. So they're going to have a lot longer progression than some of the veteran workers. So, I mean, it's just like if you had another editor-in-chief at Yahoo and you guys were doing the exact same job, but you're getting, let's say, about half the pay, there'd be a little contention there.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, it really does. It's just that it's, in the corporate world, it's not obvious, but it happens all the time, especially happens for, not to get on a feminist high horse, but it happens with women in industry all the time, So it's just that with the UAW, everybody can see what everybody else is making, so it's one of the downsides there.
So this whole two-tier system came about as a result of the recession, right?
Yeah.
So, and part of the argument was that by doing this, the auto companies would become more competitive with
The transplants.
The transplants.
That
companies.
Have much lower labor costs because they have a lot of temporaries and they don't have the legacy costs that the Detroit automakers do, not even close.
So if there's parity, then does this then mean that they're not going to be as competitive?
Analysts have said this new deal is an expensive deal, but a lot of them have speculated that it'll still keep them competitive with the transplants. It just won't help them as much as it maybe should have, like the first deal. Mm. Fiat Chrysler has the lowest all-in labor costs than GM and Ford. And GM and Ford, I'm not sure how they can take this deal and actually run with it like Fiat Chrysler has, but they just couldn't afford a strike. They couldn't afford the assembly lines to be down in a 17 million market. And, I mean,
mm-hmm. yeah. So I mean, so one of the things in the first one was, or and I don't know if it was in the contract precisely, but I'd heard that one of the ideas was that they would move car production to Mexico, and they would keep light truck production, so it would be SUVs as well as the Ram products
yeah.
in the United States. Is that part of the new one, or is that? Was that never part of anything?
That was never part of a contract.
Okay.
But the Detroit News and other reports, Automotive News, did report that that was the plan, that Ram 1500 would be going to Sterling Heights Assembly, then in turn the 200 that's produced there would go to Mexico. And Marchione himself has said that in Toledo, the Cherokee is going to move, and the only obvious place for it if Schaap is getting the pickup is Belvedere. And the Dart would then move to Mexico, make room for the Wrangler in Toledo. And then eventually the Warren Truck Plant, which is one of the oldest, most outdated plants, and it really needs to be just retrofitted and revitalized, would then get the Grand Wagoneer three-row SUV that would be coming out and by 2018 or later.
Isn't that also in part? I mean, I can understand the logic to that because cars don't have the profit margin that a SUV or a pickup does. So by moving those down to Mexico, where you pay significantly less,
yeah.
I mean, pennies on a dollar for the labor force, your car doesn't have to make as much of a profit to still be, you're in the black, right? Not
yeah.
the red.
In the black. Yes. Yeah. Black is good.
In the black.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, look at, you're talking about consumers. Look at their love affair for SUVs, crossovers, and pickups. Even if there is a high spike in gas and it goes up significantly, people are still going to want that roomy vehicle, particularly with crossovers getting a lot more fuel efficient nowadays. So you want to build your high-margin products where your high-margin labor costs are, and that's what they're trying to do right now. Ford's already announced it as well. They're moving all their Michigan Assembly Plant products pretty much to Mexico, and from what we've heard, they're going to build the Ranger and possibly the Bronco there. And it's just a move in the auto industry right now.
So the Michigan Assembly Plant makes the Focus, makes the C-Max, and another product there?
The electric.
I don't know. I'm sure the billions of dollars in DOE loans that were given to that plant will go to help more fuel-efficient pickups. And
well, I know when President Obama came to visit the plant, it was actually on downtime because the vehicles weren't selling.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to bus in people to have them come there and listen to a speech. For the speech about electrification mm-hmm. and alternative vehicles, it is showing that you cannot sustainably build small cars in the U.S. like they wanted to when the auto kind of bailout occurred.
Mm-hmm.
All these cars now, the Dart was part of that as well. So was the 200, I believe. And now they're just being pushed to Mexico.
But, I mean, in fairness, the Dart and the 200 are two exceptionally bad vehicles. The 200, which I always thought had potential to be a good one, and for other reasons I have a close personal relationship with, it's just never had any success. When it came out, they were talking that, well, we really want to get fleet sales below 40%, and they still haven't done that.
Yeah.
In the Dart, out of all the compact cars, I mean, there's not many that I would recommend the Dart over.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this great field of compact cars, and the Dart, especially because of those Fiat engines that they were putting in them, were horrible to drive.
The Tiger mm-hmm. Sharks. when they first came over.
Yeah, I mean, they feel like Me Too cars, you know? I mean, they're just, it's just, it seems like the U.S. automakers just have this really bad habit of feeling like they need to be in every segment, and they put out these products that are not necessarily competitive, and then it's, you know, for me, I, having covered the bankruptcies in depth and covered all of the union negotiations there, watching what's happening again now, sales are back up to 17 million. It's almost like everybody sort of collectively forgot what happens, that this is a cyclical industry, and that even though it's, we're at 17 million, it's going to tank again. And, you know, everybody's betting that it's going to stay here for a long time. And
I would say the workers are betting that it's going to stay here for a long time. They've got the kind of just forgetful memories from
We got a question from the audience, and we got to get this because we don't want the audience to think we're ignoring their questions. So Armand says, it was stated in Autoline Daily, I don't believe that, that the union buried the fact that FCA can double the amount of temporary workers it has. Did the UAW make a big mistake in doing this, and will it cause the new contract to go down in flames? And is it even real?
Will not cause the UAW contract to go down in flames. And burying it is a little harsh because the contract is literally 400 pages. Yeah, I was versions of it.
Yeah, I was looking at it today. It's just crazy.
I mean, I printed out.
I wouldn't even read the whole damn thing.
I did read the whole damn thing and printed it out at work, and it's thick. It is quite thick. But yeah, under the agreement, and Bloomberg has reported the percentage exactly, that they could go from 4% to 8%
of temporary workers.
Yes,
and this would be like another tier. This would be like tier minus two, or?
Well, temporary workers have never been considered to be part of the tier because they aren't there all the time, and they're not exactly full, they're full employees, but they're temporary workers. That's what they are. They fill in on vacation. They fill in on absenteeism. They fill in when on vacation or kind of product launches, like at the Ram pickup or anything like that.
They pay dues, too, right? Union dues. Yeah. But comparatively, we're talking Nissan is at something like 40 to 45% temporary workers. Hmm. So, you know.
Is that the model you need to deal with the cyclical nature of the cars? Because you could be at a point where, you know, I kind of poke fun at the 200. But
kinda.
But you have to have.
Didn't you just say we're like really nasty?
You have to have two lines going on that all the time.
Yeah.
And so, and that's not just because you're selling them. I mean, you're forcing yourself to build some that then you force yourself to do the fleet sales, which then lowers the residual value, which then hurts the car more along the way, but in part because you were always keeping two lines going.
Yeah, and like we were talking about, I mean, they need to lower their labor costs and they need to lower their legacy costs. And having more second-tier workers come in over the first tier and have this progression plan is much better for them. And even if those second-tier workers do get up to the $29 an hour or whatnot, the health care costs as well as the actual pension costs, because they don't get pensions like the first-tier workers do, are substantially lower and will help them in the long term. So, I mean, it's they've really had to trade off a lot of things and pull a lot of levers. And to say that they buried it, I wouldn't go that far.
All right, so we'll take the buried out. Okay.
But, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the contract that You can read between the lines what might happen in 4 years.
Well, speaking of cars that are not selling very well, that are from this company, so the head of Fiat brand in the United in North America, Jason Stojcevic, I just mangled his name, and
it was close.
Was it close? Okay. So he's been with Chrysler, now FCA, since 2005. He started out as a district sales manager, and then for a while he was head of Jeep operations. You know that?
You do that? His resume, but yeah.
All right. And so then he left last week.
Yeah,
just left. And you know, it seemed to me that, and I think you were on the, wasn't you on the 500X program? And, I mean, the
Pope program, or
no, the 500 the 500X when they were doing the launch. I mean, and this guy, I mean, he was very enthusiastic. He thought this would be the salvation of the thing. And so what's the deal there? I mean, what's going on with Fiat in this market?
Well, Jason did leave after the Fiat brand was taken away from him. There were a bunch of management changes that pretty much put all the car brands under Tim Kuniskis, who's the CEO and president of Dodge right now, who's done really well with that brand, and he was previously with Fiat brand, and he's also had a little dabble with Chrysler. And then everything else for the Ram brand was put under Mike Manley for the pickup SUVs. But Jason was supposed to be head of fleet operations now, and then he had another business title. But to be honest, I mean, a lot of people leave Chrysler. I don't, Fiat Chrysler, FCA US LLC, whatever you want to call them. And it's a high-demand, high-risk kind of company with Sergio Marchionne at the helm. So maybe he didn't like the way he got shifted from Fiat to the fleet operations. But, I mean, working for Marchionne, a guy who works 24/7 almost besides sleeping, it's a hard gig.
So why do you think that Fiat is not doing better in this market?
They have one car. They keep selling one car.
It's a
small
car.
It has turned into the Brady Bunch movie.
The biggest thing.
Bob Brady? What's his name? Father Brady. The Father Brady keeps designing the same house, and then he puts a little sushi sign out front, and then it's a sushi shop. Then he puts little gas pumps out front, and it's a gas station. All we see is the 500, the 500 Abarth, the 500L, the 500X.
Isn't there something to be said for consistency?
I think they made a huge mistake calling it the 500X. They had a small crossover that they could have named something else and gotten away from that 500 name.
So we're going to hear from Bridgestone Firestone, and we will resume this lively conversation about Mr. Brady and other members.
What was his? I was about to say Tom Brady.
All right, and the name we couldn't remember was Mike.
Mike Brady.
Mike Brady.
Brady.
Architect extraordinaire, and he just kept putting different signs and little.
I'm going to put the things, bad, different badge on the back of the 500.
Little things in front of his house, and that's why they're not doing very well.
I don't think they've ever straightened out the dealerships as well, and that's certainly been a problem. You see some 500
called, like salons or something like that.
Who knows?
What are they called? They're not called dealerships.
And they've dragged
studios.
They've dragged their feet on the Alphas, and I thought that Alpha would actually sell more Fiats. I thought people would come in and look at both and say, "Well, this is only $20,000, so I'll buy this one." Slow to market with the Alphas as well. Yeah. I mean, the Spider is what, just now arriving, just this year?
Yeah, it's arriving in summer, and I mean, that car's a lot. It's a niche product. It doesn't have power steering. It's a great, fun
like
car.
It drives like a go-kart.
It is awesome to drive on a track.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to drive it to work. I wouldn't want to drive it to the grocery store.
You want a pothole in it?
So, you know, sort of speaking of that, so IHS Automotive, we've had Stephanie Brinley on the show. We've had Michael Robinette on the show, and that's IHS Automotive.
Name dropper.
No, I'm just trying to have some consistency here. We've had you on the show.
Do you say that we had Scott Burgess on the show?
I tell everyone I meet that I know Scott Burgess. I mean, you know, I don't even need to be on camera, and I just tell them I know who you are.
Just checking.
Yeah.
But, I already got a photo of you and tweeted it.
Yeah, this is like you've seen Scott Burgess. So anyway, they did this look forward, and you know, as you were talking about how everybody in the world says that, you know, car sales can go up and up and up, and so they're saying car sales at least until 2022, maybe we'll have a 19 million unit year here. Mm. Anyway, they were projecting that Alfa Romeo will sell a whopping 37,000 vehicles in the United States in 2017, and Sergio had said that they'll be selling 150,000 Alphas here by 2018 as part of his grand plan. And anybody think that's going to happen?
No.
No way. No, and you know, I mean, I've sat in so many of these sales forecast meetings that it's I don't know. It's like chatting with Santa Claus and talking about what are you going to get for Christmas. Like, ultimately, there's no...
Yes, little girl.
Yeah, yeah. There's no connection with reality because I remember sitting in one where I was told that cars were going to go up to 25 million a year because of immigration issues and people wanting to have three cars and, like, all this stuff. And then I think about 6 months later, the industry just completely tanked. So, you know, forecasting is a really dangerous business. I mean, you have to do it in the industry because you have to buy supplies and you have to deal with dealerships and all that stuff. But if you're investing based on what somebody's telling you is coming forecasting-wise, I think that's a really bad idea.
Alpha was supposed to have a new product pretty much every 6 months, this cadence. And so far, all that it has is the 4C convertible or the Spider, and then they unveiled the Julia in the summer, and that isn't even close to coming here, at least for right now, from what we've heard.
And that's a beautiful car, too. You know, I mean, I think that that's a really nice car. And the 4C is a really fun car to drive.
It is for a
third car. It's the least practical car around. I mean, the carbon fiber tub is about this wide. And just to climb into it. And then when you get in it, it's really disappointing. You go, I didn't know that Parrot made radios. And, you know, I mean, there's just like some of those little touches that you get disappointed in. A guy that goes has the money to throw $70,000 down for a weekend track car. Sure,
at least 70. And I mean, this the Julia is their renaissance vehicle. The Alpha 4C was kind of their vehicle. Let's get our name back out there. This is our halo car right now, but we have all these new products coming that are going to have the new Alpha DNA. The problem is they haven't got them out there quick enough, and it's just taken a long time to get those vehicles from over in Europe to here and actually get the products to the ground.
So it's this whole Shakespeare thing. We got Alfa Romeo, and Julietta,
It actually came from one of the royal families out there, and their crest is pretty much the shield on the white and red shield and then the snake. There's a whole history behind the Alfa Romeo brand and the name, and a lot of people in Europe actually know it. And you see the cars all over the place, actually, in Europe. They're like seeing a Chevrolet driving around.
So, you know, you mentioned that it reminded you of driving a go-kart. And Steve says the issues you mentioned with poor Fiat sales seem like the same problems may be dragging Mini down as well. What do you think about that, Mr. Burgess?
Once again, I think
Scott Burgess, who has been on the show previous times. I just wanted to mention that.
I think I used the Mike Brady reference to Mini as well.
On a previous show or somewhere else?
Somewhere else.
I thought all auto critics loved Mini.
Do you love Mini?
Yes or no?
The new redesign?
No, do you love Mini?
I don't love the new redesign. That was one thing. But that's going to be all the Minis. All those dashes are going to have that weird, I was at a rave last night and now at 4,000 RPMs tachometer that it has. Yeah. And you know, there is some, what is that one?
The Countryman?
The concept that they showed that they were going to bring with
that. Super Leggera.
That was a really cool car.
It didn't look like a Mini.
That might be also the point. Minis have a cult-like following, and they'll buy all of the different ones. But there's really, it's like Baskin-Robbins with just one flavor.
Well, and aren't all these flavors just vanilla with something else put in?
Yeah, they're swirls. And so maybe Stone Cold Creamery would be, they mash something else in. But it's the cars are very similar.
Well, I mean, they're also cars. Go back to Fiat Chrysler and Ford talking about moving production to Mexico. Car sales aren't what they used to be, whether especially the small cars. I mean, Mini, Fiat, people want room. They want crossovers. I just think that market's going down.
Yeah, I have a soft spot in my heart for Mini because my dad used to race them in rally races back in Europe. But so I really have a thing for their look and their styling. But I think in America, they're a hard sell and they're never going to get mainstream because most people see small cars and they think, oh, it's going to be fuel efficient. But that's not at all what Mini is about, you know, and that's never what they're meant to be about. And so there's always going to be a little bit of disconnect that if you're going to give up the space, people are not as into driving here that they're going to, like, you know, a lot of people, you really have to like driving to want to give up all that space.
Is there something, I mean, that they're trying to, you know, they're trying to be big and they're trying to be small and they're trying to be middle and they're trying to be off-road and they're just trying to be all the stuff, but yet Mini. Isn't there something?
It's gotten progressively bigger. The Minis, you know, from each generation, it gets bigger, just like all of America. And, you know, so you have that issue that you have this name Mini, but your cars keep getting bigger. Some of the bigger ones, the all-wheel drive Mini is really fun to drive. It's a really great car, but it's not very small. And, I mean, I like probably the Mini Cooper most of all. And I think that's the cheapest of
small,
the bunch.
The small two-door.
Yeah, three, I guess, with the back.
But I mean, is the issue that it's not doing well because it's sort of like Mike Brady's design?
I think the pipe is only so wide, like Sharon is saying.
This would be the new metaphor I think we ought to use forever.
The pipe's so wide, and it's not going to get that much wider.
Yeah, so what's wrong with that, though? I mean, if you can make money, and if that's successful, and you've got a brand following, why does it... I mean, I think that we get kind of caught up in the percentage increase over last year, but if that's the size on the market and the people who are buying them are happy, why does it need to keep growing? Why does it need to keep getting bigger?
I mean, it doesn't have to stand on its own either.
Sure, but
if BMW is doing okay, and all of the other brands that fall in there, they're doing okay. So overall, it makes money for the company. Does it need to grow that much?
I'm just saying, I mean, it's a company. It wants to make money. It wants to grow a profit share. But, yeah, to Scott's point, they're just one cog in the giant machine.
Yeah, well, I mean, then we get into sort of debating capitalism and the stock market and whether or not we should really be judging success based off of year-over-year growth and all of that stuff, which is just too much. But I do think that there is some – if you're making a satisfying product, you've got a good fan base, you're making a profit, I think that that's a good – that's a good.
I don't know if many owners want it to grow that much.
No, why would – you know.
Well, you know, I've been on the rallies, and they're insane people, and they're really fun and really cool, but I don't think they want everybody to own a Mini.
But, I mean, you know, Sharon, to your point earlier that you go to these things, and they said there's going to be a 25 million unit year or whatever, and I mean, and it's all predicated on unit growth and not necessarily predicated on profitability. So in other words, that if you had a car company and you sold 10 cars, but you're making a lot of money. Who cares, right? I mean,
you know what? Actually, oddly enough, this gets back to, I think, a lot of what Sergio Marchionne keeps trying to argue is that there are just too many cars and too many brands and too much out there.
Too many companies.
Too many companies. And, like, you know, there's too many Minis and there's too many Fiats. You know, there's just it's too much right now to support all of that. That's where the growth needs to come to support all the different variations.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we're all measuring the wrong thing. Or a wrong thing.
Well, a wrong thing.
But GM has said that they want to go more by profit margins then. But.
So, okay, we're going to hear from Henkel, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about Uber, which makes zero cars.
Is Karl Marx your next sponsor or something?
Well, I was going to bring up for the loyal following Subaru.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
So we're back here, and we're not going to talk about Fiat, nor we're going to talk about Mini. So we're going to talk about Uber. It seems to me that whenever we hear about Uber, it's generally about, you know, some city that is banning Uber or some big protest from taxi cab drivers that are against Uber. And I found this thing. It was it came out earlier this past summer. Ben, can we show the line of the top Uber cities? And so this is the, you know, we're speaking about making money or not making money. And so these are the cities. So if we can roll this and we can show these cities that these are the places where Uber is making a non-significant return on its investment. It just sort of struck me that, wow, you know, if you look at places like San Francisco and London and Washington and New York and Boston and Paris, that these are the sorts of cities that people, if you're selling anything, that's where you want to sell your products. Today, Uber came out and announced that they're going to have their drivers participate in Amber Alerts. So there's more than 180 cities in the United States where they'll be looking for people who are lost.
Not causing them.
No. Yeah. They also announced that their Uber Rush delivery service. So this is basically when, you know, you have just that desire for that steak dinner that doesn't have delivery service. They'll go get it for you and they'll deliver it to you. I know that's important.
It is.
there's a they have a deal with a MasterCard fuel card with ExxonMobil, whereby drivers can get things, you know, bonuses for using this card. In September, they gave $5.5 million to Carnegie Mellon to support the research in robotics, which I basically means autonomous vehicles. They've got a situation with Hilton now, where all Hilton Honor members who sign up with Uber get a $20 certificate for their first ride. They've got it set up so if you book your hotel through Hilton, there's a ride reminder button, so when you're getting ready to leave, you can hit this thing, and there'll be an Uber car waiting for you. I mean, it just seems to me that this company is becoming almost, you know, monumental in size and scope, and I wonder, is it going to have an effect on the auto industry? What do you think?
Oh, an effect on the auto industry. That's so I'm off in a different direction on Uber. I think it'll definitely... I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of Uber, to be honest with you. I mean, I feel like there are regulations in the market for a reason, and there are often consumer protections. And I feel like companies like Uber and Airbnb are skirting a lot of regulations that have, you know, that actually are in, you know, supposed to help me as a consumer or help me as a member of society. You know, I don't know if I necessarily trust getting into a car with someone who has very little training. I have a lot of issues with Uber, and I'm sort of surprised at how much it's taken off. Maybe my perspective is different, but I just don't feel as safe in an Uber car as I do in regular taxis, and it's just sort of bizarre to me how willing people are to get into a car with just somebody who signed up with an Uber app.
And you like Uber, right, Mike?
I love Uber.
You love Uber, okay.
I use it on a weekly, if not sometimes daily basis when I was traveling in Europe with my wife. We used it in some of those cities, Paris, London. And I mean...
You used it in Paris? You didn't worry about them, like, tipping the car over that you were in?
No. I mean, there's no money. There's no hassle. When I was in Europe, all that I had to do, same Uber app that I had here, hit it, request Uber X Ride or Uber Black Ride. Then there they were. And, I mean, it completely tracks everything that you do, and you can see the driver, you know the driver's face, you know their star rating, for God's sakes. You can change the settings to just kind of only pick up certain people if you are one of the drivers.
So what's the star rating mean for the people who...
Every passenger rates the driver after they get done. And I believe, from what I've read, every driver rates the passengers. So then everyone knows what level everybody's at. And I love it just because it's easy. And especially in Metro Detroit, taxi services are horrible. And when you do get into a taxi here, they're usually dirty. There's rips in the floor. And it's just not a good ride. Uber is simple. You can type in how much, where you're going, and it'll tell you how much it's going to be. And it's just simple. It's at the click of a button, you have your own private driver. And I know in the big cities, New York, I've got a lot of friends who live in Chicago, it's becoming a huge thing there because it's another form of public transportation, pretty much.
People see it as a verb. You know you're doing well when the name of your company becomes a verb. And, you know, you don't copy something, you Xerox it. And, I mean, it's done phenomenally well. Impact on auto industry, I think that we're starting to see impacts with car sharing and different kind of financing of vehicles that you have that. Uber is also doing leases or selling people cars so that you earn the money first to pay off your car and then you can keep earning money. I think that may be some places where you see a direct impact on it. The only other thing would be bigger back seats.
Well, see, what I wonder about is that, okay, if we look at it from the point of view of, okay, if Mike is taking more Uber rides, he doesn't necessarily need to have two cars. I'm just picking on you here, so not necessarily you. Okay, so if you're a young person, let's say you're you know paying off college loans, you need to get to someplace, you might say, you know what, I'll just do, you know, I'll just use Uber, and therefore you're going to start losing incremental volume in the industry.
Yeah, but Uber's not that much cheaper. I mean, I took an Uber in San Francisco, and I went about 25 miles and it costs $250.
Nothing's cheap in San Francisco.
Well, that's true. But I mean, and you don't know that until you're done, and like it sends you a receipt. There's no like meter going off. You're done, and wow, that was a really expensive ride. So it's not any cheaper. So I think this will this is happening in places where there's already a public transportation infrastructure of some sort. Detroit is different because Detroit has its own issues. Yeah. But, you know, people are taking these in lieu of taxis in places where there are already taxis.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of the people the big cities there, a lot of people probably don't even have cars like Chicago and New York. They rely on taxis. So they necessarily don't own a car in the first place.
Right.
We have seen, though, automakers actually hopping on board with things like Uber and launching their own type of Uber companies over in Europe a lot. Fiat's part of it. They've got about 150 cars out there with a partner. And I believe because they're out of Europe, GM with Opel just launched something as well recently where they're pretty much owning an Uber company.
Right. So, I mean, so they see that this is going to have an effect on their volumes in some, maybe it's a minor way now, but...
Yeah, and Ford, I mean, has been talking about mobility for... Mm-hmm. Since I've been covering it for 6 years and just saying, we need to change this, we need to do something. And that's one of the things they're trying to do is partner with ride sharing or partner with companies or become companies like Uber to appease a different generation of drivers.
You know, and I wonder, like, okay, so if people are going to have, you know, so Uber cars are basically a person's car, right? I mean, it's a normal individual's car. Won't they have to start designing the interiors of these cars somewhat differently because, you know, suddenly you're going to have other people in it that aren't members of your family or your friends or whatever? I mean, and so you know, that might truly have a change on the way automotive designers have to look at this.
Well, you saw that with Priuses when all these Priuses became taxis. Those back seats can't handle anything, and they would be falling apart, you know, within 6 months. Whereas those Crown Vics that were always the taxis, they had, you know, that half-inch vinyl or whatever it was, and they would last for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, that Toyotas are traditionally pretty tough vehicles, but they're not taxi tough, and right. They really just get beat up.
I was just out in Portland, and pretty much every other ride that we got was a Toyota Prius, either taxi or for an Uber. And, yeah, it's not very comfortable in the back seat, and like I said, they take a beating.
So how was was the material all... dirty and
no, it's usually clean, and they have regulations, and they've got to inspect the vehicles and everything like that. But to get your point, it is kind of odd when you're hopping in someone else's car. And I have done Airbnb too, and I prefer a hotel over Airbnb, but I still prefer Uber over taxi.
Okay, and so, and I'm sure there are many Uber cars that are made by our next sponsor, Dodge. So we're going to give a shout out to Dodge here. So
I prefer cutting the tax man out.
You do.
I'll use Airbnb, Uber.
We don't have to worry about predators like our ancestors did. No saber-toothed tigers stalking from the brush. No dire wolves circling the camp. There are no more monsters to fear. And so we have to build our own.
The driver.
And we're back. And as you can tell, we can continue the conversation. You're not here. All right, speaking of driving in places like San Francisco, which brings Tesla to mind. So Tesla came out with its autopilot, which is basically its hands-free system for its cars, which people who have paid, I think it's $2,500, are having this downloaded to their car as we speak, which is sort of interesting that, you know, that this company is really doing this over-the-air updates to vehicles, which I think is something that the other OEMs need to catch on to. But what I thought was interesting about this is that he introduces this thing, but he basically tells people that this is hands-free driving capability, and we're seeing the sensor array here that the autopilot functionality is going to be having. But he doesn't recommend, he being Elon Musk, quote, "We're being especially cautious at this stage. We're advising drivers to keep their hands on the wheel just in case," which sort of seems like this huge oxymoron. Oh, here's our hands-free driving, but use your hands. This is the, what you can see on the screen.
Well, Mercedes technology does that too. So when you get it into, it'll do lane keeping, it'll bring you around a turn, it'll sense the car in front of you. I think it's fabulous. It's one of my favorite things to drive these days. But it also, like, it'll sense when your hands are off the wheel, and it'll kind of yell at you and say, "Here, get back into." I mean,
so hands-free driving is hands-on driving. You're just not necessarily
sort of half paying attention driving.
Everybody, I mean, none of this technology is that great. I mean, it's not. I'm not saying that it's not great. It's not new. I mean, I've done test laps with Cadillac on and they're going to come out with
Super Cruise,
the Super Cruise, and it's the same thing. And Hyundai has this technology, and Mercedes is. You're right. I mean, that's one of the best ones. Is it's really good.
Yeah, Volvo has it. FCA has it. I mean,
the car will come to a full stop. I mean, it'll do just about everything. I'm not sure.
I was going to say the hands-free versus adaptive cruise control, which the company, some companies are still trying to figure out. Because even in adaptive cruise control, you've got your hands on the wheel. But then if a car just cuts you off, I mean, your speed significantly drops. And at some different points in time, I was going over a hill with it, and it didn't sense any cars in front of me, and it just sped up.
They need to be refined. I mean, that's the thing. Right now, some of the systems are not as sophisticated as others. And so some of them are, when there is a car in front of you, it'll slow down significantly. And then as soon as that car goes, it just wants to get right back up to 75 or whatever you've set it at. Some of the better ones, though, are more like they ease in and out of speed. And they can kind of sense the cars around you as well and kind of take that into consideration. So there's a huge variety in the quality of them. And so I wouldn't know, not having test-driven Teslas, where it stands in the quality. But overall, I think it's going to be a good thing for.
So, is this an inevitability? Is this technology going to be something that is just we're going to get autonomous driving?
I hope so.
I don't think nearly as quickly as people think. The 2020 is not that far away, and you thought the UAW contract was thick. Wait till you see the liability contract that owners will have to sign.
I don't think autonomous is just going to happen in a snap, but I mean, adaptive cruise control and things like Super Cruise or Tesla's new thing, I think that's going to become more standard for the luxury market. It's just getting people to actually accept it and use it. And I mean, for Elon Musk to come out and say, still keep your hands on the wheel, a CEO of GM, Ford, or Chrysler could not come out and just say that. They would get torn apart. But because of their ownership base and how many cars they have on the road, and him being him, he's allowed to do that.
Yeah, I think it's going to come faster than you think it is. I think it's already coming. I mean, you can get it in a Jeep Grand Cherokee. You know, I mean, like it's already coming into more mainstream cars. But the question is, are people going to use it? And the important thing I think about Tesla having it is that Tesla is one of these cars that the first adopters like to see themselves driving, even if you can't afford one. They're the pioneers. And they're the ones who then sort of spread the word about what's cool. And I do think it's like, if you're in it, it's the closest thing to driving the future, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know traditional car people don't like it, but you think about safety issues, you think about, you know, this is the only thing that's going to make texting behind the wheel safe. Because nobody's going to stop texting. No one is going to stop texting.
But bite your tongue.
I don't think they will. No. I don't think they will.
I think that all of these technologies are texting and enablers that it makes it easier to do all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. People are doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of stuff, you know, you can put those blockers on your phone that, you know, you're going a certain speed and you won't be able to text anymore. Or you could talk to your car. Talking to your car is still as distracting. Having, like, that extra sense, set of eyes kind of looking out and...
Well, and with the Super Cruise, I mean, it literally keeps you in your lane and it keeps you a distant length. And in rush hour traffic, I mean, I love driving. But nobody lives in rush hour traffic, and I can't stand it. And I go insane because I feel like I'm wasting my time, and people are horrible drivers in Detroit. So if you can just hit a button, have that vehicle stay in your lane while you're in slow-moving traffic, and maybe text, look up online, read an article, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
JM1 NB quips, self-driving cars have been around for 100 years. They're called taxis, or in your case, Uber cars. let's move on. So today, there was a recall in Germany of $8.5 million. Well, 8.5 might as well be 8.5 million Volkswagen diesels. And just think how much money this is going to cost these guys, if it's even a dollar a car to bring them back, which, of course, it won't be.
About $8.5 million.
You're good with math. That's good. I like that. So is this just going to be horrible for Volkswagen going forward?
Money-wise?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've already seen their stock fall. I think that there's going to be a long, long payback for this. And I think that, you know, the biggest issue is just the sort of willing deception that happened. It's going to take a long time.
And Scott, you made an interesting observation when we were sitting about.
We're already starting to see everybody talk about. There's a new focus on hybrids. There's a new focus on all these energy efficient cars from all these other brands. Toyota just had the announcement that they're going to eventually, it'll all be hybrids. And all of that seems to also remind you of Volkswagen, even when Volkswagen isn't in the news. And it seems to be in the news every day.
The mainstream news, too.
And, you know, it's just.
Well, but to the point of, you know, to consumers, which you'll be more interested in now, that are not necessarily the enthusiasts, the people who may have bought these cars with the bad diesel engines in them. I mean, so think about it. I mean, you've got this problem that, so you paid a premium to buy this car, and now the value of this car is somewhat dubious because of the resale value goes down. You bought this car because you thought it was going to have fantastic fuel economy. Now you find out it doesn't have this fantastic fuel economy, and therefore, when they make the adjustment, you'll probably have less, so it'll cost you more to buy fuel. I thought it was interesting. The FTC, which looks at deceptive advertising claims now, is looking at Volkswagen. And
that's
ain't good for these guys.
You know what it makes me think about, though, because I remember covering this diesel issue before. Before they were able to come up with the solution, and it was really like this big concern. You know, we don't know what we're going to do. We don't want to use the urea systems and all that stuff. We don't know what we're going to do. And then they had a. Now, what you hear if you talk to people in the industry and you say, "What's the big issue?" People are saying, "We don't know how we're going to hit these new CAFE regulations."
Yeah.
And it is a concern when you talk to a lot of engineers, a lot of people, like, they really don't know how we're going to hit these new 54.5 CAFE regulations. So it's got, now I'm thinking, okay, who is out there trying to game the system? Somebody's got to be out there gaming the system or lobbying to get these laws repealed or something. Something's going on behind the scenes that we can't see yet. Because if there's this much concern and this much money riding on CAFE and green and all that, and people know that we're not going to be able to get there, there's something has got to be happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm.
Well, regarding the CAFE, they do have that mid-term review.
2017.
Where, yeah, a lot of the automakers feel that that number could go down. And, I mean, it kind of has to be, like you said, I mean, the automakers, for one, don't have the profits to do it. And legislators right now, if they hear an auto company is cheating or it's unsafe, I mean, they're out for blood for the auto industry.
All right, I'm going to disagree with both of you. I think that the automakers are going to stick with the 2025 number because they basically made a commitment to doing that, and I think that they've got their engineers working on that, and it would be very expensive and difficult for them. And the other thing is that if you know the FCA contract that you went through, the 400-some pages, right? You look at this ruling for the EPA to get this fuel efficiency number, and it's all footprint based. And let me tell you that, you know, it's the people who are going to be screwed are the ones who are making Honda Fits and, you know, small cars like that. Get your pickup trucks and big SUVs. their numbers are different, it's not going to be a problem. They're going to get it.
I don't know. I mean, you said earlier when we were talking, you said you can make promises out to 2050, and who's around? I mean, we were talking about 2015 that they agreed to this, what, 3 or 4 years ago?
They'll get it.
It was such a long, I mean, of course I'd say yes, you know? Like,
they reluctantly said yes. Reluctant at that time.
No, but this is like playing hard to get. Of course they're not going to say, oh, yeah, we'll be in with that. But they did all sign. They all signed up for it. All right, so last week, Youngblood had called in. We didn't get to his phone call. And so he pointed out the interesting thing. We were talking about autonomous vehicles and so on. So John Krafcek left TrueCar. John Krafcek, formerly of Hyundai, John Krafcek, formerly of Ford, is now running the autonomous car thing for Google. You guys have any comment on that?
They'll be in the paper more. I mean, Krafcek is... All the automotive journalists love Krafcek because Krafcek is so approachable. He talks to you. He makes you feel really important. And I think that that's probably the right time for Google to bring him in.
I agree. I mean, like, Krafcek is just, he's just a good guy to hang out with. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if that says about, you know, well, how we judge
look
executives.
Look at it this way. When Hyundai went through the gas problem, that thing was gone in 3 months.
Right.
And I'm sure a lot of that had to do with Krafcek at the helm of that.
Do you know him at all?
I've spoken with him with TrueCar and even Hyundai mm-hmm. before that. And I think you're going to see more executives hopping over to places like Tesla, Google, Apple. We've already seen Apple start hiring up a lot of different people from the industry along with Google. I just think it's going to be more and more of this coming.
All right, and so there was another change this week, and this sort of gets back to you. Klaus Busse, who led the interior design for FCA US LLC, a Mercedes guy who once told me that he, and we've had him on the show, and we've also had you on the show, by the way. It'd be Scott Burgess. We've had Klaus on the show, great guy, I love that guy, and now he's going to, where is he going?
He's going to go lead design for Fiat Chrysler over in Europe, Africa, and I believe Asia, and for Alfa, Maserati, and Fiat. And, I mean, Klaus is he's a great guy to sit down and talk with. I always try to sit down with him at the different Fiat Chrysler events. Mm-hmm. I think the last time I did it was the Renegade. And he's not pompous. He's very open to talking about things. And if something wasn't his idea, he will say, here's the young designer who actually did this, and then let him mm-hmm. kind of take the field. And I think he's going to do great things. I mean, and we've still have Ralph Giles kind of overseeing everything, and everybody knows him as well.
Mm-hmm. You know Klaus.
Yeah, he's awesome. I mean, he really is. The most recognized and most interviewed interior designer in the auto business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he does a great job of representing the company, but he also kind of explains the thinking and in what was the problems that they encountered. And he was one of the few guys that would say, you know, yeah, we tried to get that, but they wouldn't give us the money. And so even on things that if you found things in it that you didn't like, you might. He'd either defend it or he might say, yeah, this is the best that we could do with what we had at mm-hmm. the time.
Yeah, you know, it's probably a good job for Klaus. It's probably, you know, a higher, greater job for him. And I think he's got a good team that he's grown up over the years that he's been here. But, I mean, I think it's a real loss for what we would just call Chrysler. I mean, the local Chrysler sort of thing, you know, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, that sort of thing. And I'll be sorry to see.
And, you know, he was also one of the guys when the merger, when they were breaking up, when Mercedes or Daimler and Chrysler were parting ways, Klaus chose to stay at Chrysler, not to go with Mercedes. And he had that choice.
Right. And he once told me that the reason he did that was that he thought that he'd have a greater opportunity to have more of an effect on a company by, you know, going with a the challenger, the scrappy company that needed to get somewhere rather than going with Mercedes.
They're willing to take a little bit more risk, and it's the Middle East, I believe, not Asia that he's going to be with.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Fiat Chrysler, they do let their people take risks. And, I mean, look at the Jeep Cherokee, for example. That doesn't look like your traditional Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And they had four or five different models at the end, and they chose the one all the way to the left compared to maybe making it look like a Wrangler or even a former Cherokee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think with Klaus's departure, I think we can wrap this up. So,
awesome.
Sharon Carty, Yahoo Autos. So one just goes to Yahoo.
Yahoo.com/autos.
/autos.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Burgess, who's been on the show many times and will be on the show.
This week, go to MotorTrend.com. Next week, go to Yahoo.com/autos.
And this week, as in, like, up until tomorrow.
Tomorrow. One more day.
One more
then
day.
I think
and then after that...
site shuts down.
Just forget about that other thing. You don't... You know, it's over, right?
Yep.
Okay. And Mike Whalen?
DetroitNews.com. That's simple.
That's that simple. So, and I'm at AutoFuelGuide.com. So, let's see. Friend Autoline at Facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. Follow Autoline on Twitter at Twitter.com/Autoline. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. John will be back here next week. And thank you all for watching. And thank you all for being here.
Yeah, thanks,
Gary.
Thank you. Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at Autoline.tv.